You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today our show is going to talk about two things they say that you should not talk about at the table: politics and religion. Actually, we're going to take a look at the historic election of a new pope, one with who's got roots in Illinois, right here in the Midwest heartland. This story is going to, we're going to look at what's the impact of this historic election on Catholicism, and of course, see what impact the new pope might have on American politics. Everything is political these days, and that certainly is going to have a role as well. With me today to shine some light on all this is one of the most preeminent experts on the Vatican I've read. I've followed his work in the Wall Street Journal over the years. He's now writing for the Atlantic. He's Frank Rocha. And Frank, I'm so pleased that you've taken the time to be on today. I've been looking forward to this for a couple of weeks here now.
Well, thank you, Robin. I appreciate that very much.
Well, tell us, let's just start with, tell us a little bit about the new pope, his background. Then we'll get a little bit into how he became pope, and really a kind of a surprise.
Certainly was a surprise for most of us. He, as you know, as you mentioned, he's from Chicago. So he's the first pope from the U.S. born pope. And that was long considered to be an insuperable obstacle, that somebody from the superpower would also be the leader of the largest religious organization in the world. It helped a lot when his name was being mentioned for a while, and whenever it would come up, you know, I would raise that objection, and people would say in the Vatican who knew him or who knew about him would always say, well, you know, they don't really think of him as an American because he spent so much time in Latin America. He was in a missionary bishop in Peru, speaks fluent Spanish, and he spent a lot of time in Rome as the head of his religious order, the Augustinians. So I think that probably turned out to be true, that a lot of people thought his U.S. background was not, they could overlook it or tolerate it. For some people, it may have been an advantage. There's speculation, and I don't know how much weight to give this, that the Vatican's in financial straits, and they thought an American will know how to clean it up and also be able to raise money, because America, the U.S. is where the money is. So,
interesting. Yeah, he. It was funny. I don't know if you saw it all, Frank, but here, immediately when it became known, there was a battle between whether he was going to be a Cub fan or a White Sox fan, and it was just hilarious to watch the different memes on Twitter. But take us through his journey. I'm particularly interested in his time spent in South America, and that's where he first met Pope Francis before they both went to Rome.
Probably. There's a video of him online in which he tells people down in Chiclayo, Peru, where he was a bishop, that he knew then Cardinal Bergoglio, the future Pope Francis, when they were both active in Latin America, and that they didn't always get along. They didn't always agree. He kind of said that with a smile, and he said, I won't tell you why, but that they'd had some conflicts. And then when Bergoglio became Pope and took the name Francis, that he said, I was relieved, because I thought, well, I'll never have to be a bishop now. He'll never make me a bishop. But in fact, he did. So we don't know the story behind that. I mean, he took over a diocese that had been led for a long time, for decades, I believe, by priests of Opus Dei, which is a conservative organization in the church, and not one that the Pope was Francis was terribly fond of. So there may have been a desire to kind of moderate that or counterbalance that by putting someone in. I'm not under the impression, I don't have any reason to believe that father, then bishop, then cardinal, then prevost, and then finally Pope Leo, that he was hostile to them or anything. It seems to have gotten along pretty well in his diocese from the initial reports. People there speak very highly of him. Of course, he's now the Pope, so they probably ought to speak highly of him. But I think he got along, but that may have been why Francis made him bishop there.
Then he was brought in to Rome in a position that, based on what I understand from your reporting and all, is fairly significant. Discuss that. How did he come to be selected for that position, and what exactly did it do?
Well, that's interesting. The job that he held for a little bit more than 2 years at the end of the last pontificate, so until Francis died, was to be the prefect of the dicastery for bishops. But simply put, it's the office that advises the Pope on the selection of bishops in most of the world. So it's very important. They have to process a lot of information and look for the right people the Pope wants, because in most cases he can't, you know, he can't be thinking about making the choice. He makes the final choice, the Pope does, but he's obviously gets a lot of information and proposals put in front of him. So the previous head of that office had been left over from the Benedict pontificate, and Francis never replaced him. But it was said that Francis really ran the office directly through staff members and didn't give that cardinal, who is Canadian, as much authority as he should have had. So the prevost was Francis's man. Again, it surprised some people when he was chosen. It surprised me, because I had met prevost before he was a cardinal, when he was head of the Augustinians back in the pontificate of Benedict XVI. And I remember the main thing I remembered about him, aside from interviewing him, which I did on video and is now available on YouTube, but it was he gave a speech at the Vatican 2012 that was very much what you might call a culture war speech. He talked about the Western mass media promoting anti-Christian lifestyle choices such as abortion, euthanasia, but also same-sex marriage and adoption by gay couples. And he talked about that very strongly, which is not the sort of thing you heard under Francis. And so I thought, that's funny. I wouldn't have thought that he'd be the Francis type. But evidently he was. And another thing is that right before Francis went into the hospital in February, so near the end of his life, he did something that's below the radar for most people, but he raised Cardinal Prevost to the rank of a cardinal bishop. There are three ranks of cardinals in the College of Cardinals: bishops, priests, and deacons. And he raised him to the highest and smallest level. So that was really a sign of favor and kind of an anointing. And it may have been a big factor in getting people to vote for him in the conclave.
You know, we move. Now I want to talk a little bit about the conclave, because I read reporting on this. And just for our listeners, I am not Catholic, but I've always followed this because I've been intrigued by it. Because it's important what happens in the world. And from my political angle, my political hat on, Catholics have always been a swing vote in the United States. And I've got a lot of friends who I discuss this with. So I think it's important to our country generally, but also to our politics. But this conclave, I was reading several articles, your work as well as others, and Prevost's name never seemed to come up. And of course, everybody was speculating who might be the next pope, but his name wasn't one of the top ones. He really, and again, in sports terms, it's fair to call this kind of an upset, a surprise, is it not?
Well, he was on some lists, I have to say. Not all of them. He was on some lists, top 10, top 15 lists. And I have to say, in the run-up, in the closing days, I had one source in particular who's one of my best sources over the years and who knows this scene very well, kept saying to me, "Prevost, Prevost." I didn't actually publish a list, so I can neither take credit for that nor do I blame myself for not. I thought, okay, I take that seriously. But I remember talking to some cardinals right toward the end, and they were, they said, yeah, but there's this rumors that he mishandled some sex abuse cases when he was in Peru. Not that he was ever accused of abusing anybody, but there were it was said that he and they weren't sure about that, but they thought, well, maybe that's a bit of a cloud. In the end, that didn't seem to be an issue, and it's notable that it hasn't really come up since he was elected. I think there have been a couple articles. Eventually, somebody may bring that up again, so I probably discounted it. I can tell you that when the white smoke came out on the fourth ballot, you know, on the second day of voting, I was, along with almost everyone else in that neighborhood, assuming that it was Cardinal Parolin, Italian cardinal, who had been the Secretary of State, because it was said that he was coming in with 40 or 50 votes. As it turns out, from what I hear, he made a disappointing showing on the first ballot, something on the order of 20-something votes, and so did a conservative cardinal. I can't verify this, but this is what I'm hearing. A conservative cardinal, Erdo from Hungary, and then Prevost surprised everyone by being in that same range on the end, but he hadn't been expected to come on so strong, and so I guess that was the beginning of his momentum.
It was a double surprise in some ways, the fact that it was decided so quickly, and plus that an American was chosen. I know you've covered you can share how many of these events you've covered conclaves, but it usually kind of lasts a little bit longer, doesn't it, historically?
Well, the last few conclaves haven't really. Two or three days is probably normal. But it was thought that this time there'd be a longer one. The conservatives wanted a longer one because they were not happy with the people who were expected to do well at the beginning. Francis did a couple of things. He appointed a record number of cardinals from places that had never had cardinals before. You know, places like Laos and Tonga and Papua New Guinea and places that are on the peripheries, as he would say. And then he didn't bring them together, as his predecessors had done, to meet and to talk. He did that once with open discussion in 2014. It didn't go well from his point of view. They didn't like his where he was going on divorce in particular. And so he never did it again. And so, as a result, these people didn't know each other very well, aside from the ones in Rome. But everybody knew Cardinal Parolin because he was the Secretary of State and he traveled all around. So that was why it was thought that he would be the favorite, but it was thought that he was too associated with Francis's pontificate. So in short, the conservatives wanted a long pontificate so as not to rubber stamp him, or should I say the anti-Parolin people, many of them were conservative, most of them were. And so that's why it was thought maybe there will be a long conclave, but they just didn't have the numbers. In the end, Francis had appointed 80% of the electorate. So they didn't all agree with Francis on everything. They weren't carbon copies, as we used to say. But they were, you know, I think broadly sympathetic with him.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today we're discussing the election of the new Pope, an American Pope from Illinois, from Chicago, roots in Chicago. And with me today to do that is Frank Rocha, who's a longtime reporter with the Wall Street Journal for many years now, with the Atlantic, who I've read personally a number of years, going back, back to when, back in the 2000s, I think. And he provides very clear and perceptive writing on religion, not just Catholicism, but global religion. And I recommend you read him in the Atlantic. We've been talking a little bit about some of the background on Pope Leo's selection. I want to go right to the selection of the name Leo. That's interesting to me as a non-Catholic, what name they select. What's the symbolism of that name, what it means?
Well, he said that he had several reasons, but the main reason was to emphasize his connection to Leo the 13th, who was a pope at the end of the 19th century and who remains best known for having initiated the modern phase of Catholic social teaching. He wrote an encyclical, which is considered the most authoritative form of papal teaching, called Rerum Novarum, on the new things, and about the changes that were happening into the economy, into society, because of the Industrial Revolution. And in some ways, it was what we might say was a progressive teaching, and talked about the rights of workers to organize. And on the other hand, it was very leery of socialism and liberalism. But in any case, it grappled with these issues, and he suggested that he wants to do something similar for what AI is doing to our economy and to our society.
Got to bring this up now because I know a lot of our viewers or listeners are probably wondering the same question. But the movie Conclave came out with kind of stunning timeliness to a degree. I watched it, and it was very interesting. And I'm sure you watched it as well. Is that kind of the way the process works, based on your sources and what you know? It was, you know, a very political process internally with the conclave and the number of people that get together. But how accurate was that movie, in your opinion, in depicting real life events?
Well, I think the idea that there people are politicking and teaming up and is true. I mean, sometimes, you know, Catholics will be defensive about that, and they'll say, you know, it's not mere politics; it's prayer, and they're waiting, looking for guidance. And I think that's true and sincere for most of the people involved. Absolutely, I'm sure they are praying for guidance. But first of all, as one cardinal was saying to me before and after the conclave, he almost pounded the table. He said, the Holy Spirit does not choose the Pope. The cardinals choose the Pope. The cardinals pray for guidance from the Holy Spirit, but they don't necessarily, they may get that guidance, but they might necessarily follow it, not necessarily follow it. So and the other thing is that, yes, people, I mean, one cardinal talked to me openly about our side. Oh, this is very bad for our side and so forth. So absolutely, it's not. It's you know, there's a Catholic idea that grace works on nature, and so human nature involves politics, and that's very much at work. So in that sense, I think the movie is broadly accurate. I think I thought I found the movie a bit frustrating because I thought it was a bit ponderous, and the part I liked best was the portrayal by Sergio Castellitto of the arch conservative, which was a character and a caricature and ridiculous, but very entertaining and over the top. I thought, I thought there was people have rightly criticized the fact that the character played by Ralph Fiennes is so blithely violates the secret of the confessional, and I don't think that's realistic. And the settings were not the Casa Santa Marta where they stay is not so gloomy as it is on the movie, but that's sort of a quibble.
You had written a little bit about possible media influence in this process. Can you explain that a little bit? What you meant? How the media might have had a role, somewhat of a role in this?
Sure. And by the way, this is a bit awkward. I just wanted to add, you very kindly recognize that I'm writing for The Atlantic. I am, but I'm also writing for the National Catholic Register. I just want to plug them because they're my main employer right now. So,
okay.
But I'm very happy to be associated with both the publications. But in any case, media, yeah, as I mentioned, the a lot of these cardinals didn't know each other. And so that accentuated something that was the true already, which was these, you'd think they all come with a big notebook or a big binder full of information about each other, but they don't. And so they rely on the media. And I remember a cardinal telling me this years ago about previous conclaves. He said, we rely on the media. So that's kind of scary, Bravey. But, it's not a scientific process in that way. And many of these people most of them don't have the staff or the resource. I mean, they have the internet. They can't consult the internet, of course, once they go in there. All technology, they're cut off from the world once they go in there. In the run-up, of course, they can. And there were attempts to influence it. There was at least one group that published, it was a conservative group that published an encyclopedia of all the College of Cardinals, and focusing obviously on the ones that are that were most likely, with the information about them and where they stand and what their statements have been on certain issues and so forth. So whether that had any impact, I don't know. It might have. But certainly, I think they were definitely reading the papers and watching TV to try to learn about each other.
It's interesting. I've got to follow up on that a little bit here. You had mentioned, you know, the culture wars before. And of course, you know, we're Benedict was more of a conservative pope. The more recent pope, Francis, was perceived more progressive. And everybody's trying to look through the tea leaves right now to see where Pope Leo is. I've read kind of hints both ways. Some statements seemed a little more conservative, some a little more progressive. What are you seeing right now? It's very possible he could be both, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. He's not going to fit into a one side or the other. But I would say it's clear from the beginning, especially when he emphasized social teaching, and it's clear from statements he made before that he will certainly continue broadly the line of Francis in terms of, you know, defense of migrants and the poor and peace. And I mean, this is pretty much what you'd expect. It would be very, very hard to imagine somebody getting elected who didn't take those positions, or also the environment, care for creation. I mean, these things, Francis emphasized these a lot, but he was not out of the mainstream on that, even if he chose to give a special emphasis to them. Although I should say, with geopolitically, he's already given a hint on certain regions. He made a statement on Sunday about China, which was, I'm sorry, I pronounced it China that way. I guess we all say that now. But in any case, he said, they talked about concern and the trials of the Catholics in China. And we know that Francis put a lot of energy in a rapprochement with China. He made a deal. He allowed the Chinese government to have a say in choosing the Catholic bishops there, which has dismayed some Chinese Catholics and conservative Catholics outside of China. Not only conservatives, a lot of people, Catholics outside of China, were dismayed by that. So Francis took a pretty friendly approach to China, and he even said there's freedom of worship in China and that sort of thing. And so that's a hint that maybe he'll be taking a slightly tougher stance, at least. Okay, so that's one thing. Another thing about Ukraine, Francis was very much he was criticized by the Ukrainian Catholic hierarchy for being too pro-Russian. You know, he said that the Ukrainians should raise the white flag, and he blamed the war, not on so much, he avoided blaming Putin. He said that it was, you know, NATO expansion that had provoked Russia. So again, Leo has come out and said that he wants a just and enduring peace in Ukraine. That's a bit different. And then also, I think perhaps on Gaza, he certainly expresses distress about Gaza and wants a ceasefire, as well as the return of the hostages. But remember, Francis had talked about terrorism. The IDF's, the Israeli campaign in Gaza was terrorism, and he said it might even be genocide, and they should be investigated for that. Whereas Leo has not said anything like that, and he also made a gesture very early, the first few days of his pontificate, toward Jewish leaders to want to have a good road. So those are areas. Then there's the issue of moral teaching on sexuality and medical ethics. We know, of course, that Francis, most famously with his most famous remark as Pope, "Who am I to judge?" He seemed to signal. We can debate what he was trying to do, but over 12 years, the effect was to say to play down that certainly sexual ethics. You know, he was much more relaxed about that, and of course, toward the end of his pontificate, he approved blessings for same-sex couples, which, you know, in the previous pontificate would have been unthinkable. I don't think anybody would have believed if you had predicted that was going to happen in 2023. But this man hasn't shown his cards yet. Someone who knows him very well for many years told me he plays his cards very close to his chest. So, I mean, he did make a statement in the first few days to diplomats. He said marriage, the family is founded on the stable union of a man and a woman. He didn't have to say that. It was a bit, he sort of threw it in there, and it got some attention. It raised some eyebrows and gratified some people. But so who knows? He yesterday it was announced that he'd appointed as the head of the Vatican's bioethics think tank, which had been the focus of controversy under Francis because it included people who were not necessarily pro-abortion rights or and not necessarily even religious believers, as in an effort to have dialogue. But he appointed a man who had said to me, actually, in an interview a couple of years ago, that contraception can be permissible in some cases, which is, you know, not what the 1968 encyclical Humanae Vitae said, and which the conservatives are very much, want to reaffirm. They reaffirm that prohibition. So what is that a sign of? We don't know. We'll see if he, my understanding from people who know him well is that he's center right, if you want to put it that way, on these issues. He's traditional, as that speech he gave in 2012 would suggest. But whether he'll be pounding the drum very hard, is not clear.
We just have time for one more question, about 2 minutes here, Frank. I know it's very soon, but how would you assess the legacy of Pope Francis?
Wow. Well, clearly he was a pope who put a huge emphasis on the concern for the poor and the migrants and creation. He definitely pushed the teaching on the environment forward and developed it. I think that, and the fact that he was the first pope from the Americas and the first pope from the global South, he'll remain, that will be recorded in the history books. The other stuff may fade from memory, depending on how things go from now on. If he turns out to have been an anomaly in his sort of leniency on teaching on sexuality, then perhaps that won't seem so significant. His kind of very, very impressive use of the media to kind of counterbalance church teaching is a subtle point that I think maybe historians will remember, but most people won't. But I think he'll be remembered as this pope from the global South, the first from the Americas, who really put an emphasis on the poor and on the migrants and on the environment. That will probably be his place in history, I think, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, it's soon. I think I'll be watching for more of your writing on that as we look back at his legacy, but also look forward. It's been a very interesting conversation. There's a lot more, but we have to cut it off here. I really appreciate you taking the time today to share your thoughts with us for all of us in this area. Frank Rocha has been my guest today. He's formerly with the Wall Street Journal, now writes with the National Catholic Register, correct? And he also writes for the Atlantic, where I've read his work. He's been with us today to talk about this historic election of an American as Pope, somebody from Illinois, which is, I think the whole story is very interesting, and it'll be, I think, worth our while to kind of follow this. It'll have important impacts on our country. And again, I thank you, Frank Rocha, for taking the time to kind of provide your analysis on this today.
Well, thanks, Robin. I really enjoyed it.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.